in the recent book on radio documentary production called Reality Radio. And we are very pleased and delighted to have Scott with us today.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction and thanks for inviting me. It's good to be here. I'm a producer of Hearing Voice. I'm afraid Barrett Golding, the executive producer, might be listening, so. Barrett, I can fix that one. I'm just kind of curious. This is the first time I've been to Canada other than just passing through it on the way to Alaska and back. I'm wondering if you have a word for people like me, arrogant Americans who come here and think that this is the United States. Can't tell the difference. There must be a word. I want to know it. What is it? Because I keep thinking, oh no, this is a parallel universe. It's not the same. You don't want to say it? What is it? It's a secret. Okay, all right. Well, since the theme of this afternoon and the whole conference is home, I wanted to play a couple of stories that I produced almost 20 years ago, about 20 years ago, the late 80s, the mid to late 80s. I started working in radio in 1983, and most of my stories between 83 and about 86 were travel stories. I'd travel around and interview people I met and collect tape. And at first I'd go back to Washington, to NPR in Washington, and produce the stories there. And then I I bought my own equipment and started working at home in Salt Lake. And so I'd leave and come back to Salt Lake and produce stories. And at a certain point, I guess I got married and we had a baby, and I felt like maybe I shouldn't be leaving all the time, although I did keep leaving, but I thought, well, I should be able to travel here in Utah, and why not just be able to just do the same thing in my own neighborhood and not leave, work on stories here. And so this first story that I called The Neighborhood was my first attempt at that. And I'm gonna play that one, or part of it. Both of these stories are about 20 minutes long, and I cut out, we're just gonna play about half of each. But the first one, The Neighborhood, I patterned it off of a photojournalism book called Suburbia by Bill Owens. I don't know, maybe you guys haven't seen it, but it's a fairly well-known photojournalism book. It was used for the film Edward Scissorhands. The sets in that movie are all lifted straight from the book. Bill Owens was a photojournalist for, I think, the Sacramento Bee. And he moved into a suburb outside Sacramento, and he felt so alien there that he just decided to start taking pictures of his neighbors. And he used a wide-angle lens, black and white film, and there were compositions where he would go into the people's homes or into their yards and talk to them, get to know them, and then he'd pose them in their favorite room in the house, the bedroom, the bar set up downstairs, the garage. And it was just a wonderful book. It's hard to talk about unless you can look at it, but I thought, I could maybe do that on radio, you know, just without the pictures but only sound. So the idea was to present people that I met around my neighborhood and around Salt Lake, and like turning the pages of a photo essay book. That was the idea for that one. And the other one I'll talk about after this first one's over, but both of these stories, they wouldn't be played now. I guess it was, in a way, it was kind of surprising. The first one, The Neighborhood, was played on Soundprint, And I think in about 1986 or 87. But the second one was never broadcast nationally. And anyway, after we hear them, we could talk a little bit, if you want, about why they wouldn't get played now. So this one was, the first one was done with money from a program that went defunct right after I produced this story. It was called the Satellite Program Development Fund, and it was a CPB, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, fund to help independents produce stories and distribute them on their own through the satellite system. And that's kind of how it begins with that. So why don't you go ahead and start it.
The Radio Science Foundation presents Man with a Microphone, Part 2, The Neighborhood.
That's my dog. He's okay. And these are tapes I made in my neighborhood. Some are sounds I recorded around my house. Some are things I taped off the radio. And others are interviews with my neighbors. I live at 474 G Street, Salt Lake City, Utah, and this program is my neighborhood scrapbook.
I think I should like to use those marvelous words written by Parley P. Pratt as something of a theme. The morning breaks, the shadows flee, lo, Zion's standard is unfurled. The dawning of a brighter day, majestic, rises on the world. The clouds of error disappear before the rays of truth divine. The glory bursting from afar, wide o'er the nations, soon will shine.
Okay, well, I would wonder what my house is like from somebody who comes in from the outside. And so I try to meet it that way a lot of the time. And when I meet it from the outside, I'm real puzzled by it. This isn't the house that I thought I was designing for myself, but it's the house that happened up around me. This table's gone through 17 moves. And the other things have long histories of their own that they came to me with already. Somehow I kind of guard and cherish those histories too, and what they do to my imagination. My grandmother's chair and my ex-husband's godmother's couch. But I'm kind of a Bedouin, I think. You know, I have had 18 moves in 20 years. I know how to pack it up and leave within one night and set it up someplace else. So if something dies on the way, it gets, you know, buried properly and left behind. I mean, this is how I've dealt with the outside world. This is what I've gone out and tried to structure a reality, and this is where it is. You know what I mean?
In neighborhoods I've lived in from the time I was a kid up till now, have always been cold. There's a fence that separates that lot from that lot from that lot. And this separation, by virtue of symbols like fences and gates and private property and so on and so forth, or even dogs that'll bite you if you dare go into the area, all of this has emphasized what I call the isolation of individuals and families from each other. And this hasn't been improved at all. There is a feeling of stay away from us. You do your thing, we'll do our thing. Now, there are exceptions to that, for sure. But if you don't have a fence, if you don't have a closed-off area you're in trouble. And I think that's one of the most distasteful signs of society degeneration.
What we really have is we have a brand new 50-year-old kitchen. I like this space here. I invented this. I always hated pulling out bowls, even though you can stack them from a cupboard. They're always awkward. So this is just an open square area. It's just open on the front side. You can put, well, I guess there's about 12 bowls all stacked in here. You don't have to lift them out of anything. You can just pull them straight out and pull the bowl that you want. And this cupboard over here, it's pretty nice. I had them put a little shelf here to put the waffle maker on, and I can put, I have a pasta maker in the basement, you know, a narrow shelf, and underneath you can put the toaster and the coffee grinder, it all will fit. And then over here, there's so many of the kitchens, they just don't have a place for something tall. I can put my whole Cuisinart in here without taking it apart. Because, like, when you start having to stack it, it takes about 5 times as much space. And then I have some tall vases and jars and things. And I don't know, what do you think? Do you like it?
Summer when it dries up, the dust just, and they didn't have, my mother used to wash on Monday with a great big boiler about this big. She put on a coal stove, and she'd dry it all and iron on Tuesday, and everybody had to have a bath Saturday night because we had to go to church Sunday morning, spotless clean, and then, I mean spotless. And Dad would see to it, too. I don't know, they were funny. You see, there's a star coming right there. Looks like it might be going to warm too little.
Neighbor of yours. I live around the corner. Well, who are you?
My name's Scott Carrier, and I live around the corner down there on G Street.
You don't live around the corner here. I know just about everybody that lives on this block.
No, I do. I live down there. I live down there.
Where do you say you live?
Around the corner down there.
Down where?
I live down on G Street down there.
G Street?
Yeah.
G Street and what?
About 9th Avenue.
Well, what are you doing up in that tree?
Well,
you're acting like a damn fool. Now come on down. That's over 20, 30 feet high. If you fall down, God knows what, I'm responsible and it'd be a hell of a mess. Now come on down.
Just let me stay up here a little bit longer. I'm almost done.
I'm not gonna let you stay up there one more minute. And if I could, I'd climb up and take you down by the seat of the pants.
Good Lord,
you can't even have a tree on your property anymore for fear that a fool like yourself is going to climb up it and fall off. Come on down. Are you going to force me to call the cops?
Please.
I'll skip through to shorten this. There's probably about 5 people we're skipping over. Let's go to the last 5 minutes here.
I pick up rocks that I find are interesting. I don't really do it because I think they're rare gems or, you know, rare rocks, you know, some agates and things like that. I pick them up because they're interesting. They kind of look like, this one here looks like it came from outer space. It's some kind of agatized rock. It's got oranges and purples and whites and, I mean, you know, that orange is almost the color of a crab's back after it's been cooked, and that purple is a, well, it's kind of hard purple to describe. It's a waxy texture, and it's a darker, almost a mixture of a purple and an ox blood red. Why did I pick this one up? It looks like there's a lot of fossils in it or some sort, just little pieces of some kind of fossilized material right through here and right through here and through here and right through here. Just curiosity.
My name is George Nay, N-A-Y, but I belong to the Full Gospel Businessmen Fellowship International. And at 16 years old is when I found the Lord as my personal Savior, was baptized with the Holy Ghost and spoke 2 hours in the Spanish language that I had never learned. Just the camp meeting we had here at Parowan this fall, in July, it was around the 4th of July, the camp meeting. One night, 150 people received fillings in their teeth the Lord put in. It saved my granddaughter. She was one of them. It saved us over $1,000 we'd have to pay for dental work. Now, a doctor can cut you and he can sew you up. He can do a lot of wonderful things, but he cannot heal you. There's only one healer. And a dentist can fix your teeth, but that's no sign that they're not going bad again. But Jesus can fix them to where my wife's had one for over 22 years, a beautiful filling the Lord put in gold. And the Lord puts in gold, he puts in silver, and he makes teeth white also. So Jesus makes the difference. We just love every one of you and appreciate you. The Lord bless you.
Do you want me to read my poem to W.S. Merwin?
Let me see it. Let me see if that's one.
This is the one to Merwin. I gave him an answer. I said, dead hands, ha ha. You may talk about the basilisk, Merwin. I'll tell you about dead hands. It's It's got nothing to do with letting...
People don't know who, so they won't...
Let the rings fall. Dead hands, dead hands. I know dead hands. But I stare like the basilisk at these two lines of Merwin's, and yet I know dead hands. Once warm, caressing my silk, my skin. Before they turn to wax in the casket, with veins vanished after life's... Red was sucked away in that hushed morgue. Dear God, do they run that blood down the drain? We are not going to go on with this, Scott. That's not... I'm not going to finish that. There's a simple little poem in here. There's a simple little poem that isn't so bloody. Y'all? No, I'm not talking to you. Go away. I don't give a damn. It's not... We're not talking to them.
Okay.
We don't have to. Just because that phone rings, why should a person have to talk to a phone? Someone terrible, I know it is. I know that it is someone terrible. No, that's why I know it's someone terrible. It isn't father, it isn't family, it isn't girlfriends, it is someone terrible. I am not getting it. That means it's a man. Stop it. I'll unplug you.
You have been listening to The Neighborhood. This program was produced by Scott Carrier with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Satellite Program Development Fund.
Yeah, I like that ending. I wish I could end all stories like that. But all right, so that one's about Salt Lake City. Just west, Salt Lake City sits at the base of the Wasatch Mountains, just to the east of the city. But to the west, there's this desert that is called the Great Salt Lake Desert. We call it the West Desert. And so I call this story the West Desert because the intention on this one was to do like a cultural history about the people who've lived out there in this very sort of sterile, inhospitable, and even hostile terrain. This is where the salt flats, most people have seen the cars trying to break the land speed records on the salt flats. It's the Great Salt Lake area. At one time, 15,000 years ago, there was a huge lake that covered most of western Utah, parts of Nevada, and even into Idaho. It was 1,000 feet deep, and it's bigger than Lake Michigan. And what's left of that lake is the Great Salt Lake now. And the reason why the Great Salt Lake is salty is because there's no outlet. There's no river. There's rivers coming in, but there's no rivers going out. And so all the minerals stay in the water, and that's the salt. Anyway, it's one of the least populated regions of the United States, and it's a place where most people don't go to for recreation or just other than to drive through on the way to Wendover to gamble, or to get to the San Francisco, the West Coast. So I wanted to, basically I did this story because I wanted to know who was out there and what it was like out there. And so this is more of a serious report. So it's the West Desert. It starts with a quote from Mark Twain, who went through on the stagecoach, the Overland Stage, in 1861.
Imagine a vast waveless ocean, stricken and dead and turned to ashes. Imagine this solemn waste tufted with ash-dusted sagebrushes. Imagine the lifeless silence and solitude that belong to such a place. There's not the faintest breath of air stirring. There's not a merciful shred of cloud in all the brilliant firmament. There's not a sound, not a sigh, not a whisper, not a buzz or a whir of wings or a distant pipe of a bird, not even a sob from the lost souls that doubtless people the air.
On the salt flats, every shot is the same. The ball sits on a stiff white carpet of salt crystals, So you tee it up and hit the driver. The ball flies off toward the mountain and then drops and disappears into the lake. It looks like the shore of the Great Salt Lake, but it's a mirage. You walk toward the shot and the shoreline stays 100 yards in front of you. The ball is always there, sitting on a stiff white carpet of salt crystals. So you tee it up and hit the driver. And so on for miles and miles and miles. The mountain in the distance is called Floating Island. Up high there are animals, trees, and fish. But down here, nothing. No rocks or bushes, no ditches. There are no real hazards, except for the bombing range, which is big but easy to avoid, and the mental hazard of being spooked by the emptiness. It can make you feel uncomfortable, but then it can also improve your concentration on the ball. It's obvious no one would live out here, and yet people do live out here.
I'm John Conrad. We're in the Eskdale community.
Why did your group come to the desert?
Well, one of the writings said to go into the land of the earth and to build a place in an effort to live together, all things common, similar to Acts 2. So there's, in the community, no one really owns anything, but we all own it. Of course, personal items, clothes, those kind of things are owned by the people. But cars, houses, all those things are really commonly owned.
Can you tell me about the man who founded this faith community?
There's a fellow named Maurice Glendenning. He came to Utah in the late 20s, and he had received revelations from an angel. In fact, it began as a boy, he'd just hear music, and then a voice stood out in a choir. And, you know, this went on over years as he was growing up. Finally, he could hear the voice, and he wrote down what the voice was saying. And these revelations that he wrote, everyone said they were demonic, which of course they're not, but we do believe that the Lord, through angels, through inspiration, many other means, continues to speak to people.
Briefly, can you just tell me what's going to happen tonight?
Well, we're just going to perform the Messiah.
This is Granite Ranch. I'm Keith Allred. I guess the original name given to the people living polygamy would be fundamentalist, but socially, if that was practiced and practiced in a godly manner, not after lust or to benefit man's desires or stuff like that, you wouldn't have harlotism, you wouldn't have abortions, you wouldn't have society in the way you have it today in a whoremonging type lustful society. And it takes care of the widow, the orphan, it takes care of an unmarried woman, it gives a woman an opportunity that she can choose a good man, not setting up any man that he's a better than another man or something like that, but it sets it up that a woman can have a righteous head or a righteous leader. And I think if you would look through the world today, they're far and few. I mean, if you just use the 10 Boy Scout rules, most men come far from reaching that.
Well, my name is Cecil Garland, and I live in Callio, Utah, on the edge of the Salt Desert. We are in the process here in the United States, we have already, in fact, recreated the fall of Rome. Little doubt can be had in that regard. We've lost control of our money, we've lost control of our borders, we've lost control of our courts. Our courts are travesties, and if you want justice anywhere in this country, don't expect ever to find it in the courts. They are a farce, they're a travesty. And the founding fathers of our nation who tried to create something new and different, something that the world could behold and cherish and keep, would come back to this country and go absolutely nuts.
The first white men came to this desert in the 1820s looking for beaver and the Rio Buenaventura, the river they thought connected the Great Salt Lake with the Pacific Ocean. They came in young, on horseback. A few weeks later, they staggered out, having eaten their horses, having abandoned their friends, having forgotten their own names. Their reports were full of horrors. There are no beaver. There is no river. Everywhere the water just disappears into the ground. The Indians live like animals, their houses nothing more than hovels made from little sticks, their clothes made from the same sticks, food, whatever they pick up off the ground, insects, lizards, rats. Like dogs, they hunt without weapons. They're all witches. They can charm animals into their camp by beating a drum and dancing. Captain Howard Stansberry of the U.S. Corps of Topographical Engineers, the first white man to walk around the Great Salt Lake, said, "These Indians are the most degraded savages, and their country is entirely worthless."
You know what that means?
I think he said, "I'm Mitch, and we're standing behind the store, and this is my brother."
No, I said, waiting for the mail to come in.
White people don't let him in a hurry.
White people don't hurry up, I said. And here, the mail's already here.
So, what are you going to do this afternoon?
I'm going to Wendover this afternoon. Got to cash his check and got some big tits I want to go see too.
Dancers?
No, Dolly Parton.
Girlfriend.
You know Dolly Parton, don't you?
I don't know. Is she in Wendover?
Mm-hmm. Second Dolly Parton.
So do you guys gamble?
Oh, yeah, bet.
What do you mean bad?
You bet, I said.
You bet? Or it's...
We play blackjack.
And do you win or do you lose?
Black.
Lose every time, just like donating money.
Well, why do you do it then?
Why? Because we got the money and we just want to go have fun.
You don't care.
As long as I fill up my gas tank and I end up making it back home.
You don't care if you save your money?
That I cannot answer. I don't know about that.
What do you mean? You don't know about it.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. We go down to Wendover just to have fun, see? If not, we just stick around here.
What do you do for fun around here?
Looking for some women's, but there's nothing around here. All these girls are related to us around here, so we have to go all the way to Wendover. Or if not Wendover, we go all the way to Wells or Donna's Hacienda.
You never talk to any Indians up above?
Hey Scott, I'm going to go over to the store. I'm going to take him over. See, you can cash a check, then I'll come back over. Huh?
All right.
Because I don't know, you might have to give us a jump because my truck kind of acting up.
All right. See what happens. In 1941 and 42, the Army and the Air Force took more than 2,000 square miles of this desert for bombing ranges and work with biological and chemical warfare. And the land changed, not just the 2,000 square miles, the whole desert. It changed from being considered worthless to being considered to have value in its worthlessness. It offered open space and absolute silence. What better place to drop bombs and spread disease and poison? At the Dugway Proving Grounds in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Army and CIA personnel tested aerial and ground dispersions of nerve agent, dangerous viruses, the microbes that cause anthrax, plague, as well as the hallucinogens LSD and BZ. You may remember the nerve gas accident in 1968 that killed 6,000 sheep. By some estimates, one-third of Dugway's 1,000 square miles is contaminated and will be off limits forever. All the tests are now done indoors under very anxious safety regulations.
This is a Class 3 glove box. Remember, there were three types of safety cabinets. This is the highest level, and you can see there are glove ports. It's totally sealed up when it's in operation, and they test it with Freon to make sure there's no leaks. This is where we do our aerosol work inside of here. So we have three layers of containment. The room is a layer of containment, the chamber is a layer of containment, and then the aerosol itself is actually inside that aerosol system, inside the Class 3 glove box.
Inside of what?
This plexiglass box, that's where the aerosol is contained.
Can you run through for me?
Yersinia pestis attenuated strain, Coxiella urbanetti, which causes Q fever, Bacillus subtilis variety Niger, which is a simulant, MS2 colophage, which is a viral simulant that doesn't cause disease, botulinum toxin, which causes botulism, Staphylococcus enterotoxin B, which causes the food poisoning that's common from eating potato salad that's been left at room temperature, and T2 toxin. I think I got them all
yellow
now.
Yellow fever? Is that one?
No. I didn't say yellow fever.
Is there yellow fever here?
I don't believe so.
You don't believe so?
No, I don't believe so.
Cholera?
Vibrio cholera?
Is there cholera here?
How do you mean here?
Is there?
Do we have samples of cholera in the building? That's correct.
How about anthrax?
Bacillus anthracis?
Yes.
It's an organism that causes a serious illness. And there is treatment, there is a vaccine for it, which appears to be very effective, and there is treatment for anthrax. But once again, we use attenuated strains when we can. And we actually have a very good simulant for anthrax. So we don't use anthrax all that often.
So there is treatment for anthrax.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is it's safe and the public shouldn't worry.
I'd recommend that you come to the Citizens Advisory Committee for Dugway testing meetings.
I didn't go to the Citizens Advisory Committee meeting, but I did climb to the top of Deseret Peak, 1,000 feet above timberline. It was a clear day, just after a storm, and the air was cold like a trout stream. Snowy peaks 100 miles in the distance seemed to be within my reach. Down below, I could see the smooth sloping basin floors of alkaline mud and sagebrush. To the west, I could see lines laid out on the Dugway Valley. Some lines in a grid pattern, others in concentric circles, targets for bombing practice. To the southwest, the Rush Valley, where there are rows and rows of small concrete bunkers, like little houses in a suburban neighborhood. This is where the Army stores chemical nerve agent, enough to kill every living thing on the planet. You get just a tiny bit of this stuff on your skin or in your lungs, and pretty soon you notice some difficulty breathing. Then you begin to slobber and drool, then you urinate, defecate, and fall down on the ground and writhe about in convulsions until you go into a coma and die. The Army is now building an incinerator to destroy this poison, and it's none too soon either, as the containers inside the bunkers have started to leak. To the east, I could see the Tooele Valley, home of the Tooele Army Depot, where habitual dumping of toxic and hazardous solvents has polluted a large aquifer. And beyond Tooele, farther east, the Kennecott Copper Smelter. Kennecott has also polluted an aquifer, one that could have supplied drinking water to 50,000 people a year. To the north, I could see MagCorp, a magnesium plant, spewing a long plume of chlorine gas into the air. And to the northwest, the West Desert Hazardous Industries Area, a special 100-square-mile plot of land set aside for incinerators and landfills. This is how we use this desert. It's all planned and carried out by committees, commissions, concerned citizens, people who live and work here, people who want the best for their community. They didn't start the Second World War. They don't produce the hazardous waste that they burn and bury. When bad stuff happens, it has to go somewhere. So why not here, to this place, that we consider to be soulless, empty, and dead? All right, so yeah, that goes on for another 5 or 10 minutes, but let's play one more. Hector, the third one. This is a story that I did about a friend of mine in Salt Lake who is a sound artist, so I thought it would be appropriate for this conference. He calls himself a sonosopher, or a word shaker, and he's basically a performance poet who's been unable to get funding from the arts councils and different people because he doesn't really know how to define himself. Anyway, I think it's explained in the story. Let's just play that one. My friend Alex Caldiero came by the other day.
What's going on?
He's a poet and a scholar, a man who knows every story that's ever been told. And usually he's in a good mood, making jokes. But this time he was looking like he'd just seen a ghost.
I don't know.
Or maybe he'd shot somebody.
You know, it's a sense of frustration. I apply for grants and I can't describe the categories. I can't fit the category.
He'd been turned down again by the Utah Arts Council.
You know, I sing and I'm not really a singer.
He's missed it 3 years in a row now.
You know, I do poetry and I'm not really a poet.
I know the director of the Arts Council, and he told me one reason Alex's proposals get rejected is because he won't call himself a poet. He makes up new categories like word shaker and sinosopher. This confuses the selection committee. They give money to fiction writers, dancers, photographers, but what's a word shaker?
You know, they have to think in sound bites. They have to think in thought bites. And everything has got to be two-dimensionally stated. You know, and real art and real poetry is not like that.
Then, according to the director, there's also a problem of giving public money to individual artists because the individual artists sometimes do things that upset the public. The director didn't come right out and say that maybe what Alex does upsets people, and maybe this isn't the problem at all. But in March, for example, for the anti-war protests on the steps of the state capitol, Alex put on a white gas mask and banged on a mortar shell with a stick and made gasping noises into the microphone while two women in blue Afghan burqas spun in circles, one to either side. It scared people. It scared me, and I knew he was going to do it. And he's right. I can't think what category to put that in.
You know, and so what's going on?
Here's an example of one of his poems.
This is a lie. This is a secret. This is a lie. This is a secret. This is classified. This is a lie. This is confidential. This is a secret. This is a lie. This is a lie.
Sometimes he speaks in tongues. Sometimes he sings.
The money's gone out the window. The monkeys walked out the door.
Sometimes he tells his dreams.
A dream, February 7th, 2001. I'm with George W. Bush, President of the United States of America. We are by a lake, and it is winter. Papa Bush is there, and Mama Bush is there. It's a family gathering, and I'm one of the family. We are all by a lake, and it's winter, and it's a Bush family tradition to play the diving game. So George, President W. Bush, gets up and dives into the icy water and goes down deep and then surfaces and leaps right onto the shore. That looks dangerous, I say. Why do you do it, George? He answers, you got to go in to get out.
I told Alex not to give up hope. Maybe next year. I said, you know, if you don't make up a new category, just call yourself a poet and propose something that sounds safe. No burqas, no gas mask. Maybe just say you're going to stay home and look at your belly button. But I doubt that's going to happen.
Nomenclature. Belly button is the U.S. military code name for the one who makes the decisions. Hence the phrases. He can't find his belly button. We don't know the belly button. There is no belly button. Where is my belly button? Etc.
This is Scott Carrier. Yeah, I think that one played in 2004 on Day to Day. And I mean, Alex, that it happened like that. He came into my office and he was feeling really bad. But then I chose the poems there, and I decided to make it like a protest, because at that time you couldn't say anything negative about the Bush administration. People were terrified at NPR. Well, I don't really know, but I imagine that they were just chicken shits, basically. And so it was a protest piece that had it was disguised that way. Anyway, those are some stories from my home, Salt Lake City, Utah. Did anybody have any questions? Yeah. Okay.
It's not really a question, it's more of a comment. What strikes me is in Germany,
yeah,
we had in the 70s, 80s a very similar movement in radio play, which was called Originaltonhörspiel. You could translate it as said. Field recording radio play,
right.
And which was a political thing because it was not documentary. We wanted to give a voice to normal people, to everyday people, and who speaks normally in radio? It's politicians, it's journalists, it's famous people, everyday people. Well, they do call-ins, but you cut out the pieces you need for your show. We called it radio play, and it was protected by the label art. If not, it would have been censored. So we could really give a voice to people without any censorship. And it was for the first time these things were possible in Germany. And what hits me is that at the same time in America, you start doing things. It seems to me that always at a certain time it's necessary to start certain art forms.
What happened to it? What happened to it in Germany? Why don't they do it in Germany anymore, or do they? What I've seen in the United States with NPR and the different other systems is that it's kind of this type of program has been on the decline since I started in 1983. I think 1983 was kind of like the pinnacle or the epitome of creativity at NPR, and things happened, right after I walked in the door in March of 1983, they realized they were $9 million in debt. And that was a big sum of money back then. And it seemed like people felt really guilty about it because they'd been passing out credit cards and people were maybe had been spending too much. It was a real sense of guilt and shame in the building, and they fired a third of the staff, including Keith Talbot, who was the director of all the creative programming at NPR at that point, and he was the exact person that they shouldn't have fired. And Robert Siegel announced at a radio conference in New York in 1983, a little in the fall, that basically NPR wouldn't be doing that type of work anymore. He said specifically, we won't be playing Larry Massett's Trip to the Dentist anymore. And for people who knew this program at that time, it made a lot of sense. Siegel's a very smart man, and he just zeroed in on it. We're not going to be doing that. We're going to become an internationally recognized news organization instead. And that's the direction they've gone in. It's been very slow and gradual over the years. But as of a couple of years ago, it's pretty much over. they got, you know, they, the CPB no longer funds independent productions, individual artists anyway. They canceled Day Today, which was the NPR program that played more independent work than any other, but it was basically the only show that played independent work. And they fired Alex Chadwick, of all people. Alex Chadwick was the first person, producer at NPR, that played the Kitchen Sisters work. I'm sure most of you are familiar with those, the Kitchen Sisters. He started Morning Edition, and he was basically the best writer and producer in the building, and they fired him. He was fired by Ellen Weiss, a woman that he hired in 1983. When I walked in the door, she was the lowest person on the totem pole, and now she's the vice president in charge. Same day they ended Day to Day, they hired three new vice presidents with salaries averaging $250,000, and that's not including their staffs. So that's the direction NPR has gone in. Why? I think it's political for sure, but just speculating there. Yeah.
I was absolutely still amazed by those moments you're able to capture in the neighborhood.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and on one hand, it's like I know that there are some things that you can do to create the likelihood that those kind of moments are going to happen, but you can't entirely. It's almost like they just kind of fell into your microphone. I mean, it's kind of like a gift to get a lot of those things, isn't it?
Yeah. There were a lot of interviews I didn't use.
I'm sure, yeah. I was going to ask, like, how much material would you have to gather in order to get these really inspired moments? And how do you decide where the likelihood that those kinds of things are going to show up?
I just keep trying. It's like fishing for me, is throw the line in the water over and over and over again, talk to a lot of people, and then choose the best tape. That's kind of my method, is always try to start with good tape and figure out how to build the story around that. And in that show, I wanted to present the people as much as I could like a photograph. Or a good photograph, you can see the soul of a person in the photo, and that's kind of what I wanted the audio equivalent to be. It's like you could hear the soul or the nature of the person just by listening to them. And I also chose tape that you almost couldn't listen to. It's like, why am I listening to this? Why can't I stop listening to this? Why can't I turn it off? I specifically edited that show trying to figure out how much space can I put in this before people will stop listening to it. And I think maybe listening to it now, I think I put in too much. But back then, that's what I was trying to do. And I edited that tape. It was quarter-inch reel-to-reel, and I remember watching it go through the machine at one point. Just there were hundreds of splices in it, just hundreds throughout the 24 minutes. And just thinking, wow, I'll never want to do that again. It's just too much. Little tiny, tiny, tiny pieces of tape to space it out or cut it a little shorter.
Yeah. Do you you now edit digitally, I
yeah.
assume?
I miss the reel-to-reel, but...
What do you miss about it?
I just like watching those reels go around. And I like dragging the idea of dragging rust across, the chrome. You can watch it.
Do you feel like it's changed your editing style?
And how the stories actually come out, no. But the way that I produce stories, it changes that. It's a lot quicker now. And it's not as much fun. I remember I actually literally walked into NPR. I was really lucky and made some friends there who are, I think, the best producers in the building. And they took me into Studio 5, I think it was, on the third floor one night while they were mixing down a story about an emergency room. And it was very much a cinema verite type, no narration type story, and they had five reel-to-reel machines going, a turntable, a cassette machine, and the engineer was just not up to it at all. And so the two producers who were working on it, Larry Massett and Art Silverman, were reaching over her, you know, shoulders and moving the buttons and pressing things. And it was just wonderful. I was completely hooked at that point, watching these guys mix down this story. Just all the moving parts and all the synchronization, back timing. We used to have to back time the tapes and stuff like that. It was really fun. And now working on a computer, it's completely different.
Why do you think the West Desert never aired nationally?
You know, because of that interview with Gary Resnick, the last guy you heard there, the guy at the Baker Lab. They put me off. It's controlled by the Army, U.S. Army, and it's the place where there are two labs in the United States where we test hazardous chemicals and nerve agents, things like that. One's in Fort Detrick, Maryland, and the other one's in Dugway out in the West Desert. And I think most of this stuff happens out in Dugway. But they put me off for 6 weeks, interview request. And during that 6 weeks, I did a lot of reading and studying about it. And so when I got there, I was kind of, well, not an expert, but I was pretty up on the history of chemical and biological warfare. And he just didn't like the questions I was asking. Right after that point on the tape where I cut it on the tape, because he kept saying, "I don't know." I said, "Do you have this here? Do you have this here? Do this here?" And he kept saying, "I don't know. I can't remember." And I said, "You know, usually when people say they don't remember, it's because they don't want to tell the truth." And he said, "You see this gentleman behind you? That's Colonel so-and-so, and he will escort you off the base." And so I was removed from the premises. And he called someone in the Pentagon, who called someone in Congress, who called Bill Buesenberg, the director of news and information at NPR at that point, and tried to discredit me, saying that I'd lied about who I was, which wasn't true at all, knowing that that was the first big red flag, that misrepresentation. And I know that because I flew to Washington and talked to Bill Buesenberg, and he told me that. That show was scheduled to air three separate times. It was actually up on the board to air that day on three separate days. And each time it was not pulled. And the last time, Dan Collison, who's now an independent, he was the producer of Weekend. It was going to play on Weekend, all things considered. And that time, the host, Lynn Neary, refused to introduce it. Not because of the Baker Lab thing, but because she thought it was degrading to Native Americans. And Dan Collison quit. That's why Dan Collison doesn't work at NPR anymore. I mean, it was the last straw for him. So it wasn't, I think the first two times it had something to do with the political complaint from Dugway, Proving Grounds. And then the last time Lynn just thought it was degrading to Native Americans. But I thought it was degrading to Native Americans. I thought it was degrading to everybody who spoke in that program. I don't think I was discriminating against anybody. Or I was equal. One more question or some more? Ira Glass and Gary Covino played it on a show they had before This American Life called The Wild Room. On WBEZ in Chicago, though. That was the only broadcast that story had. They play it in Salt Lake every other year. It doesn't ever go, never becomes dated. They're still talking about the same problems out there now.
This time I have a question.
Okay, good.
could you tell me in short whether you leave in your recordings pauses, the things people do when they speak, do you correct them? Do you edit out all the things? Normally in a journalistic documentary, we cut out the pauses, we cut out
yeah.
the misspellings, we put out all the errors we do. But
what we did at that time in the radio place I told you about was leave them in because it was an part of the expression of the people.
That's the way it
happened. And sometimes even a pause, a long pause, it has a reason why the person cannot get over this point, and it shows something. Do you choose to leave these things in? And the second part of the question would be, I know it's difficult to say, but in a long recording, what is interesting for you to keep, and what would you put out, what is not interesting in a recording?
Yeah, what's good tape and what isn't good tape? Well, about the pauses, I usually cut out the pauses. I usually cut them down anyway, just because the dead air on the radio is, you'll lose the listener. So I'll leave them in if the timing's right. You know, I like to keep the natural timing of the person talking. That's kind of how I decide, unless it's excessive and I'm afraid that's just too much and people aren't going to listen to that if there's too much dead air in there. I don't think I ever put in pause more than there was. Maybe in the neighborhood I put in some pause. I put in some dead air with the people talking. I think when I make a mistake with leaving too much space, it's in the transitions. And I should have someone telling me not to do that, because later when I listen to it, I think, it's just too long. But as far as good tape, what's good tape? I don't know. I really don't know what's good tape. I just know it when I hear it. But I think basically I sort of leave in the cliches almost, or things that aren't standard cliches but are kind of a cliche in the sense that they're very short or succinct statements that show or tell a lot in a small space, because that's the important thing in radio, is you want to say as much, you want to show as much as you can in as little space as you can, and that's kind of what a cliche is. Epigram, maybe, I don't know. That's what I look for, is who can say the most in the least amount of time, or who makes, you know, me imagine the most by a few words, because that's what I'm looking for, is my imagination, or the listener's, what I think is the listener's imagination, to always keep the imagination engaged and changing, moving, so that the listener doesn't get bored. That's how I edit, and that's what I look for in good tape, is the imaginative qualities of what somebody's saying. And, you know, I think that I like to talk to, not always, but I mean, I like to talk to interesting people, but I think that average or just people that you meet on the street or in your neighborhood often, well, it's not really true. Really what it is the soul qualities of what you're listening, of what someone, what you can hear from someone's voice, whether you can hear the, or whether I think I can hear the soul of the person in their voice. And I feel like on public radio, at least in the United States now, that's the quality that's missing. It's soulless, empty, and dead. right. You know, it's over and over and over every day, all day long like that. And that's what they go for. They look for that. And I believe it's because it doesn't cause any letters to be written to people in Congress. Because in the United States, NPR is controlled by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is controlled by the Congress. And radio is the most emotional medium. Our sense of hearing is our most emotional sense. Our vision is our dominant sense, but our hearing is our most emotional sense. People hear things, they get upset, and they write letters. And NPR was called on the carpet in 1994, along with public television in the United States, and they did not respond well to that, and they are still suffering from cowering out at that point, I believe. And I don't think it's going to come back. I really don't think there's going to be a resurgence in my lifetime, anyway. I think it's over in the United States. When I walked into NPR in 1983, the creative people there were bigger and tougher and could beat up the news people. And it's just, there are no creative people. Art Silverman's still there. He's really one of the best producers ever, I believe. But there aren't many others besides that in the United States. In Canada, I wish I knew more about the CBC. I wish we heard more of the CBC in the United States because I think it's a much better system up here. I hope it is anyway.
That's scary.
Is that maybe it's not as good as I think, but
do you see any hope in like other formats and like with digital media or anything like that?
Yeah, if you could make money by stuff on the web, it would be great. That would be so wonderful if we could make money by doing things on the web. It's the ideal medium for independent producers. And I think there's a lot of good things on YouTube that I see. I teach at a university in Utah now, and I show a lot of YouTube stuff on my classes, but nobody's making any money on it. And that's, if you can't make money on it, you can't survive. And I've noticed that people with money don't work very hard because they don't have to. So, I mean, getting paid is important.
Do you take solace in shows like This American Life or Radiolab, like sort of non-NPR?
Sometimes take paychecks from them. This American Life saved my life at a certain point and still does from time to time. I think Ira's does really wonderful work and basically has engaged a whole new generation of public radio listeners that wouldn't have existed without him. I mean, he's changed more than anything in my lifetime. Ira Glass has changed, the medium and the business. Radiolab, we don't get it in Salt Lake, so I'm not as up on that. Ira changed everything. Ira and the people that work with him. Any other questions? All right. Oh, one more. All right.
I just have a listener question. I want to know if your friend got his grant.
No.
Aww.
Although I nominated him for a USA Artist grant, maybe he'll get that.
Okay.
No, they're not going to give him any money in Utah. They're not going to give him. He teaches at the same university I do, and they won't even give him tenure. And he's the best teacher there. Just not going to do it.
Okay.
Alex Caldiero is his name. Yeah. All right.
Going once, going twice, just about time for the break.
All right.
But first of all, Scott, I'd just like to say thank you for your presentation. You were talking about parallel universes.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm coming down from a parallel universe yet, and I'm not really quite there yet.
All right.
But it reminds me in a lot of ways that it's like in some ways our realities are the same in Canada and the U.S., and in some ways they're very, very different as well. And I was feeling those differences in the neighborhood. So. Huh. A lot to think about, and if you want to get into discussions with anybody, that's one of the things that Canadians love to talk about, are the differences between Canada and the U.S. and how, we are not the same.
All right, good.
So, but thank you, and I also, when I first saw your name, I wanted to pronounce it Scott Carrier as well.
Carrier, yeah.
So.
It is French, yeah, you're right.
Okay, so, but before we go, I've been asked by our conference organizers here to remind you about the raffle for the Bong & Olufsen earphones, and tickets are $10 each or 3 for $25, and they're really, really kick-ass headphones. They're the in-ear kind of thing with a frequency range of 50 to 20,000 hertz, which is a wide, wide, wide dynamic range. So please come and buy your tickets if you feel so inclined, and the draw will be tomorrow. Or the 31st, it says. The 31st is... What day is the 31st? Okay. So anyway, you won't know when you're here whether you won or not. But go enjoy your break, and we'll have another different sense of neighborhood when we come back, which from the listings and the names of the artists, I know that those neighborhoods are Montreal and Toronto, so maybe a little bit more close to our experience, but very different from yours, likely, Scott.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Have a good break, everybody. And you're listening to Radio Without Boundaries Conference, the Deep Wireless Festival, and we're just taking a break right now and going back to Deep Wireless 7 because there's so many different performances and compositions on here, and this is my first chance to hear them. So I'm just going to pick some things at random. Sarah Boothroyd has a piece on here, and I have not heard anything of Sarah's in a long, long time, and I know her from community radio circles and from conferences like this. And so we'll give this a listen right now. Let's see, this one is 7:47, it looks like. So anyway, we'll have time probably for two pieces before we resume for the afternoon sessions about neighborhoods. And so anyway, here is Sarah Boothroyd's Through a Door.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, maybe 15 cells on my left down a hallway.